giving, receiving, and creating community.
When you receive something, it's not for you to hoard. It's something for you to pass along. And you don't have to literally pass along the thing you received. You pass along the spirit of what you received, the act of receiving. And you give that on into the next person, and eventually in cycles that have elements of mystery to them. You know, we make offerings to nature. We make offerings to community. We make offerings to the soil. And it is only through these acts of giving and receiving, which I think of like inhaling and exhaling, that we give life to our communities.
That's Lola Milholland. We talk with her about her memoir of growing up in a group household. It's called Group Living and Other Recipes. Then we re-air our conversation with Chuck Collins about his novel Altar to an Erupting Sun, that's set in an alternative community in Western Massachusetts. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour, on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to find extra content with links, book excerpts, transcripts, and extended interviews. Food entrepreneur and activist Lola Milholland grew up in the 90s, the child of iconoclastic hippies. Both her parents threw open the doors of their rambling house in Portland, Oregon, to long-term visitors and unusual guests in need of a place to stay. Years later, after college and after her parents' separation, Milholland returned home. There, she joined her brother and his housemates, an eccentric group of stop-motion animators and accomplished cooks, in furthering the experiment of communal living into a new generation. Milholland's memoir, Group Living and Other Recipes, tells the story of the residents of the Holman House, with a wider exploration of group living as a way of life. From spending time at her aunt and uncle's intentional community in Washington State, to finding her footing in the kitchen as a student in Japan, and more, Milholland offers a vibrant reevaluation of what it means to create community. Lola Milholland is the owner of Umi Organic, a noodle company with a commitment to providing nutritious public school lunch, and she's a former editor for Edible Portland magazine. Lola Milholland, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I just loved reading this book. I mean, your parents are basically in my age cohort, and I lived in a lot of group houses when I was in college and after that. And in fact, I'm thinking of looking into co-housing for my old age. So I just really enjoyed this memoir, Group Living and Other Recipes, with recipes and a contemplation of what group living is all about in ways that I think many of us often don't think about. So you begin the book with an anecdote about your mother's 70th birthday party. She did a stand-up comic routine during which she said that in the 1960s, she became a disinheritor. And then she asked the audience somewhat rhetorically whether she threw away too much from her parents' generation. What did she mean by being a disinheritor? And what was her answer to her own question?
Just hearing you recount that puts such a smile on my face. What she meant by being a disinheritor is that there were a lot of societal structures that it was just assumed that she would take with her. She was raised in a very Catholic family. Her father's Filipino. Her mother was Polish. She calls herself a Polipino. And so Catholicism was a very strong influence on her worldview. She also was raised in a very patriotic family and a very patriarchal family. In her family, she was one of eight. There were three girls, five boys. The boys didn't clean the house at all. Her mother did all the cooking. There was just a lot of domestic labor, and it was truly divided by gender. And so when she was talking about disinheriting things, those are just some of the things that she disinherited. You know, my mom, we would call her absolutely a hippie. She was in San Francisco during the Summer of Love. She discovered drugs, and drugs opened up a different connection to nature for her. So those were the things that she felt she was letting go of. And when she posed that question to the whole audience, you know, did I disinherit enough? I think I forgot it was a comic routine for a second. And I really pondered that question, like, isn't that harsh? But her response with so much power was, no, you know, I didn't disinherit enough. And I remember how powerfully that came through, you know, like, how do we become more radical as we age? And what are we holding on to? And what should we hold on to? And what shouldn't we hold on to?
More radical as we age. I mean, my worldview was irrevocably changed by the 1960s, and I'm not sure that I've gotten more radical, but my understanding of what radicalism means, I think, has become a little deeper. But on the other hand, so many people become more conservative as they age. So say a little bit more about what you saw happen with your parents and even what's happened with yourself. I mean, you're probably somewhere approaching your middle years. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm almost 40. I'm 39, heading on 40. Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And it's something I guess I personally aspire to. And I love the way you frame that, which is like, it can be a deepening of what being radical means. But I think when we think about, when my generation and younger generations think about the hippies, they often conflate them with the boomers. And there's this sense that a generation that really changed our culture drastically then turned towards a more conservative view around money and personal isolation and wealth accumulation. And I think that there's a strong sense among my generation, or at least around my cohort, like, how can we follow a different path? And in the case of my parents and other people I know who are of your generation, that hasn't been the case. They haven't necessarily followed the path of becoming more conservative. And of course, we are all creatures of our time that we're raised in and the cultures that we're raised in. We can't disinherit at all. And we shouldn't disinherit at all. I think a lot of my book is about trying to understand the things I really want to hold on to from my childhood and my parents' generation and everything that people of your generation created. But I think trying to carve a path forward where we really challenge ideas about, you know, private property and wealth accumulation and what it means to really see ourselves as part of a larger community. Those are things I'm interested in and I'm trying to explore with the book and looking at both my life, but also people in my life, my parents and my aunt and uncle who live in co-housing, which you were talking about. And I just am fascinated by their ideas about how to build community.
Before we go any further, describe what it was like to grow up in the group house that you did with your parents. Talk about the house. You say it's a character, the house itself, and also talk about what it was like to live there.
Absolutely. We moved into this house I call the Holman House when I was 5 years old, and it was a very large old craftsman. And my parents immediately began working on it and getting friends to work on it and doing all these kinds of little projects. And one of the big ones they did was remodel the kitchen with a friend's help. And it just became the beating heart of our house. And my parents really had an open door policy. We had so many exchange students. I mean, at least one, sometimes two or three in a year. And then my mother's brother came and lived with us. My grandfather would live with us seasonally. Their friends would stay when they needed a place to stay. And I think an important thing is that if that's your reality as a child, then that seems normal. I think sometimes people think that my parents weren't paying a close eye to me. And I don't think that that's true. I think they really did care about creating a safe space for me, but they were incredibly welcoming. And so it was totally common for us to have many people over for dinner and for that to feel really good.
Yeah, you said that your parents had an unspoken philosophy about the house, that we only deserve it if we share it. And this is, I think, a real core theme to this book, Group Living and Other Recipes. Lola Mulholland, say more about that philosophy, that we only deserve it if we share it, and also connect it with the ideas about the gift economy that you discovered in a book by Lewis Hyde, a book called The Gift. So go delve into that notion.
Sure. Yeah, I'll start with Lewis Hyde and I'll circle it back, which is just to say, I came upon this book. Amazingly, I came upon it at a swap shop. So a place that was in a dump where you could just bring things and take things for free, which couldn't be more appropriate for this book. It's a book that looks at ideas of gift-giving cultures and applies it to the artistic and creative practices. And he really talks about, you know, when you receive something, it's not for you to hoard. It's something for you to pass along. And you don't have to literally pass along the thing you received. You pass along the spirit of what you received, the act of receiving, and you give that on into the next person, and eventually in cycles that have elements of mystery to them. You know, we make offerings to nature, we make offerings to community, we make offerings to the soil. And it is only through these acts of giving and receiving, which I think of like inhaling and exhaling, that we give life to our communities. And it is okay to receive. It is okay to be honored by somebody else's offerings. But it is important that when you do so, you then pass that along. And I think that I love your connection of that, this philosophy that my parents had. I had never actually made that connection before, but I think my parents felt that the house itself was an immense gift. My mom had purchased it in 1990, which is a time when homes in Portland were quite affordable, but it was still really difficult for her to buy. She was working at a natural foods grocery. She didn't have a lot of money, and it was a really large house, and she had grown up with a large family. And so I think she felt, if I have this place that I love and cherish, it really only is living its full purpose. I only really am receiving this gift and acknowledging what it is if I make it available to other people. And that's how it fully comes to life. And I do think that she was engaging with ideas of gift circles.
Yeah. And so now, talking about gift circles, talk about food, which is such a central part of this book. I mean, the title is Group Living and Other Recipes, and you have these wonderful recipes that I can't wait to try out in the book. So yes, tell us about food.
Sure. You know, I love food. It's very much at the center of my life, both because I have a food business and also because I really love and feel calm when I'm cooking and I live in a group house. But I think you can't write a book about communal living and not put food very much in the center of it, in its DNA. Whether or not this is a book that is solely about food, as soon as you are talking about community, I believe that food ends up playing an important role, and sort of explains, I think, why there are so many commune cookbooks. And, you know, an early version of this book was inspired by all those commune cookbooks, both kind of wanting to poke fun at them and also embrace the spirit of them. But, you know, this idea of giving and receiving, there's a ritualistic quality to it, right? You give, you receive, you give, you receive. There's both like a frequency to it and also something very spiritual to it. And I find in my own life that the place that happens most often is with food. We cook for someone and that is a gift, and they eat and they receive it. They cook for us and that is a gift, and we eat and we receive it. The farmers are offering us a gift. The, you know, land and the soil is offering a gift to the farmers. There is this just innate cycle that is taking place with food. And of course, then we are coming together and being with each other and just hanging out and getting to know each other. And that repetition of time spent is how I think you build a community that's both really strong and really soft. And so for all those reasons, I knew food had to be central to this book. And I wanted to include recipes, and not just recipes that like feed a crowd or anything like that, but ones that show the people who are in my life and the things they've offered to me. So I think of these recipes themselves as gifts that were given to me. And by including them in the book, I am offering them out to you.
And your brother, Zach, he is the originator of the first recipe in the book. He's 10 years older than you, and he was a big influence on you. In fact, in some ways, he really raised you.
100%. Always there is a lot of ways that we express love through action. And with my brother and me, it's often over sharing food and cooking for each other. And
so Zach was a big influence in terms of teaching you how to cook. Is that right?
My brother was such a picky eater when he was young. You know, I was too small to know that, but he was even a picky eater when I was just a young girl and he was a teenager. And he transformed that into this kind of concern and interest with how ingredients really taste, like, you know, what they are and how to use them and their best use. And the level of care that he brings to each ingredient is just to this day inspiring to me. There's like a presence there that just transforms the way that he interacts with food in the kitchen. And I aspire to that. I find it constantly revelatory when he shares something with me and sort of cracks it open for me. And that's been true for other people in my life too. But Zach has been incredible that way.
So for you, as you said, and it sounds like for him as well, food was a really spiritual, intimate part of your relationship. And it's kind of like Zen and the art of cooking.
Yeah.
Now, being involved with food, this is something that your mother, in a way, blazed a pathway for you in this. She got in on the ground floor of working for Organic Valley, which is the biggest dairy cooperative in the country. So talk about your mom's experience with organic food, the Organic Valley model, that turned the dairy industry on its head in a way.
Absolutely. I think my mom thought she would be a preschool teacher. She studied that. She came to Portland and ended up working in an early, if not the first co-op in Portland, which is called Food Front, and discovered that she had such a passion for food and specifically organic food and food that was raised with a consciousness about the environment. I mean, while she, during the time that you were all, you know, young and heading in towards adulthood, it's really the beginning of the Green Revolution and these ideas about pesticides and just heavy chemical use in agriculture. And you know, I think from an early age, she read many books that influenced her and made her feel like that isn't the path that creates the most life for our planet. So she had this activist passion, but she started working at a co-op and she realized, I also have a business person's voracious appetite for growth. Like, I am driven and savvy, and could I apply this intensity that I have to my activism? And so that really became the center of her business life. She worked then at a grocery store in Portland called Nature's. And then from there, she freelanced for a little while and ended up at Organic Valley. And at the time, Organic Valley was a co-op of dairy farmers in the Midwest. And it was a combination of people who were, you know, early back to the land hippies, also just traditional farmers who had small herds and didn't want to start using growth hormones. And also Amish and Mennonite farmers. And all of these farmers came together in 1980. We have a huge farming crisis, and they were potentially going to go out of business and lose their livelihoods. And they saw an opportunity with organic to change the way that they were paid. You know, the commodity market pays based on supply and demand, and they wanted to be paid based on what it actually cost them to care for their animals and make dairy products. And so organic was a path to be able to do that, to get paid for their own costs. I think it was a really big risk, and they took it. And by the time my mom joins, they're still struggling, but they're growing, and they are ready to go into a new region and welcome more farmers in. And co-ops are built, this one is a farmer's co-op, on many, many members contributing. And so to grow, they needed more farmers. And my mom was situated in the Pacific Northwest, and she took on this enormous job of, you know, finding farmers to convert to organic, finding processors who would make, you know, run organic milk as the first run of their day, finding distributors, finding grocery stores, building a customer base. And it just so absolutely fit with her passion for business, with her passion for, you know, a cause, making sure that farmers could continue farming organically and on a small scale in perpetuity. And so, you know, she was joined by many other people with passions like hers, and they were able to grow this co-op so much. I mean, in my lifetime, I watched it grow, but every time it grew, it didn't mean more money in a few people's pockets. It meant more farmers joining in different regions. And I just have always found the co-op model really moving. I mean, it is a form of democracy. And, you know, my mom rose and became head of marketing and sales, but that didn't look like being head of marketing and sales for other, in other places, you know?
And she also lived, I wasn't totally sure about how connected this was to Organic Valley, but she lived in a group house on a land trust that was associated with Organic Valley. Is that right?
Yes, you know, it isn't literally one-to-one, but the people who, some of the people that founded that land trust were involved in the early days of Organic Valley. And when I was young, she started working and having to travel to Wisconsin. At first, 1 week a month, then more. And where she would stay was this land trust because it was near the headquarters. And, you know, their first CFO was one of the members of this lodge that was a communal lodge. And so at first she stayed in an outbuilding, and then slowly she moved into the main lodge, and she still lives there today.
That's awesome. So you mentioned Japan before, and I wanted to ask you, Well, one thing is you went to Japan right after college, I believe, or as a foreign exchange student. And at one point you moved into a home of a family of a mother and two daughters. And you talked very movingly about what you learned from them, about Kyoto home-style cooking.
Yes. I mean, I can't express how fond I am of these people to this day. So I didn't know very much about Kyoto food. Kyoto was the historic capital of Japan. And I think it's just good to know that Japan is very, very food obsessed. And each region, each sometimes micro town has its own particularities. Kyoto food was influenced both by the court being there and also like a deep Buddhist temple tradition. And home style cooking, the way that I experienced it, is that every dish is presented on its own plate. And each dish is very whole in and of itself. It's not a lot of different flavors at once. It's sort of almost like what Zach taught me, which is taking one ingredient and expressing it in its fullest potential based on that moment in the season. And so you have these plates and bowls laid in front of you, maybe, you know, a bowl of rice in front of you, a miso soup off to one side, and then three or four other small plates with vegetables and fish. And you create your meal by each bite you take. You take a bite of rice, and then you might have something a little bit rich, like, you know, some grilled mackerel, and then you might want to cut it with a pickle. And so you're sort of orchestrating your own experience of the meal itself. And it's so, if you want it to be, it can be so full of intention and that kind of presence that we were talking about before that Zach has modeled for me.
Wonderful. Now, I'd like to ask you, Lola Mulholland, about some of your non-book endeavors. You run Umi Organic. This is a noodle company. And I read online that it has a commitment to providing nutritious public school lunches in Portland, Oregon. Tell us about this company, what it's about, and how it expresses your politics of food.
Yeah, I mean, it was really beautiful for me to discover the opportunity to work with School Lunch. So we started the business in 2016, making fresh organic ramen noodles, sourcing some of the flours directly from Oregon farmers and millers who were growing grains and doing it with such intention and connection to the community. And I really wanted to make a noodle for this region that expressed something about this region, something, a noodle that felt like it had some of the spirit of the food I had eaten in Japan. And so that's how we started. But then around 2019, I got the chance to meet the head of Portland Public Schools Nutrition and her assistant, Whitney and Ben, and they had become interested in serving a Japanese noodle in the district because they had allowed some parents to take over the very elementary school I had attended, which is a Japanese immersion program. And they had been serving yakisoba, which is stir-fried noodles with vegetables. And it was a huge hit with the kids. And so they thought, you know what, if it was a hit at this one school, maybe it would work district-wide. And they were searching for a local noodle. And I really took up that opportunity to make something that was whole grain rich, that was sourced from local farmers, but also I hoped that would delight kids. And I've always seen this part of our business, the school noodles, as one of the most meaningful ways that we are part of our community. I think foods that are for everyone, foods that are for all kids, there's like an equitableness to that that feels really right for the kind of culture that I want to be part of building and that I want to live in.
And you write that you have a fascination with the way that shifts in food culture reflect and influence larger cultural moments. So I wonder if you could put that in the context of this just delightful memoir, Group Living and Other Recipes. You know, kind of take us out on bringing this whole picture together.
Ooh, love that. What a big question. I do believe that what we eat and how we interact with food and its place in the environment and our lives, it changes the cultures that we inhabit. So the ways that we come together around food, the relationships that we build around food, the ways that we interact with it, it ripples out. And the more care and intention we put in, the more it influences all of us in small ways that are very, very profound. And I feel like at the heart of my book, what I'm curious about is kind of the way we can build culture through all of the small and meaningful interactions that we have with each other back to just giving and receiving with intention and being open to giving into mystery. And I feel that we have the opportunity to shift our culture drastically through these daily intentional activities and actions that we do together.
Well, that is a beautiful place to end. And this has just been a great conversation. Thank you so much, Lola Mulholland. Your book is Group Living and Other Recipes. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a joy.
Lola Mulholland. Go to writersvoice.net for links to recipes and more from Group Living and Other Recipes. Next up, we re-air our September 2023 conversation with Chuck Collins. His novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun, is set in an intentional community in Western Massachusetts, one based on a real-life collective that was dedicated to social activism. Stay tuned after a short break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Last September, we sat down with Chuck Collins. He's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., where he directs a program on inequality and the common good. He's the author of several nonfiction books. But last year, Collins came out with his first foray into fiction to explore how social justice activism has dealt with grave crises in earlier decades and how the lessons learned from those struggles can inform how we deal with the crises we face today. His novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun, is a near-future story of one intentional community facing climate disruption in the critical decade ahead. It also takes us from the anti-nuclear power movement of the 1970s to the contemporary climate movement to explore how the resistance to injustice has unfolded over the past decades down to today. The community where the novel is set is based on an actual collective in Western Massachusetts. Chuck Collins, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me back, Francesca.
Well, I was quite surprised to hear that you had written a novel. You've written a memoir. You've written other books. You're involved with the Institute for Policy Studies for many, many years. Altar to an Erupting Sun. First, just tell us a little bit about that title and why the word altar means so much for you.
Well, yeah, this is my first foray into fiction. And the book is, in a way, it's an altar. It is in the tradition of a remembrance altar, celebrating people, elders, people who've gone ahead of me, but also an altar to the social movements that form me and so many of us. So that's really the altar aspect of it. And the main character in the book, Ray Kelleher, learns about the power of altars and is kind of a builder of public and private altars.
So when you may say builder of public and private altars, what we're really talking about are a whole history. I mean, the book is a kind of a primer to the history of social justice movements from the 1970s to the present in the United States. Ray, you've mentioned her, Ray Kelleher. You begin the novel. I don't think it's going to be a surprise to our readers. I don't think this is really giving anything too much away. With an act of violence, a suicide bombing by Ray, who had before dedicated her life to nonviolent activism in the service of social justice. So tell us about Ray Kelleher and what brought her to her final act.
Well, yeah, it's not a spoiler alert. That's how the book begins. Ray is at the end of her life. She is facing down a terminal illness. She doesn't have long to live. And as you say, Francesca, she spent her whole life part of nonviolent movements. And yet here she is at the end of her life. She decides to go out, taking her own life and the life of the CEO of a fossil fuel company. And it is a provocative beginning. But it invites this question, why did she do this? And that's a bit of the history, what formed her, and what impact did it have? So there's a little bit of 7 years into the future, future fiction, where we look at the considerable negative blowback from her shocking exit, as well as some ways in which society started to shift. So it's really an exploration of the traditions of nonviolence, the different kinds of bold actions that people take, and this unthinkable, shocking act that Ray takes. So it's really an exploration of why. And that really is the story.
So let's go to how you explore the why. The early part of the book takes place in Montague, Massachusetts, at a real so-called commune in the 1970s with real people, Sam Lovejoy, Wally and Juanita Nelson, and Chuck Mathai. Tell us about that farm and its connection to the Hidden River Farm in 2016 and beyond.
Well, you know, it is a work of fiction, but I enjoyed weaving in real life people and real life places. It's very much of a place-based novel. Although if you don't live in Western Mass or Southern Vermont, I think you'll find that there are elements of place wherever you live. But in this case, you know, Ray is 19 years old, Ray Kelleher. She drops out of college because of the moment that she's living in. 1973, the Vietnam War is happening. The U.S. has just helped overthrow a democratic government in Chile. And she is feeling like, I just can't sit still in college. And so she joins a very engaged activist commune. And again, she's 19 years old, going to live with people like Sam Lovejoy, who was very active in the anti-nuclear power movement and sort of was an example of taking a bold witness. And in his case, he clipped and toppled a weather tower that was being used by the nuclear power plant company that wanted to build the plant, turned himself in, kind of an act of civil disobedience and property destruction, and he goes to trial for that. And Ray Kelleher, the fictional Ray Kelleher, sort of has a front row seat to all these things unfolding around her. So these are the people who shape her. And you think about all of us in our early 20s and who we meet, meeting Wally and Juanita Nelson, who are civil rights activists, war tax resisters, among the few African Americans living in rural Western Mass. But they are living witnesses to the power of nonviolence and trying to live a nonviolent life. You know, my hope is that people will learn about these social movements, but then, yeah, reflect on this moment we're in, the impossible news of climate disruption, and what is it we're called to do in this moment, which I think is different than 50 years ago.
I just love the way you describe the vision of community that, you know, that inspired so many of us in the 70s and continues to inspire people today. A vision of community that is really set increasingly against a complete erosion of community in the larger society. Describe that vision of community in that farm, a committed community that went beyond its, committed to issues way beyond its borders.
Yeah, I think, you know, Ray Kelleher is lucky at age 19 to find these people, to find a community, because, you know, as we know, so many people feel isolated and disconnected and don't have that aspect in their life. And, you know, these people depended on each other. They engaged in civil disobedience together. They grew food together and they celebrated. And there were children around and there was a sense of joy and mutual aid among the community. And as Ray ages, she wants that again. And she, you know, later in her life, she calls herself sort of a late in life back to the lander, but she and a group of people, you know, together buy a farm, and now they're in their 50s and 60s, and they realize to face a disrupted future, to face the coming years, you know, we're going to need each other. We're going to need mutual aid. And she sort of says that there's a little bit of a joke there, which is, well, we don't necessarily all want to live in the same house and have the same kitchen and bathroom, but maybe it's more like co-housing. Maybe it's more like, you know, we live really close to each other. We share a great deal. We have a little bit of more private space, private lives, but we're trying to have that, weave that sense of community and celebration and joy of life together, because that's how we're going to get survive the coming years.
Yeah, and could you delve more deeply into a description of that later community at Hidden River Farm in Guilford, Vermont? What are the things that people do? And first, you know, tell us, how does mutual aid, after all, mutual aid is a movement, certainly in this book, that begins in the city and then is translated to the country. Describe how that works in this place.
Well, they live in a rural community, so they're connected to sort of the wider community and their neighbors. But at the farm, they're trying to grow food. They're trying to add value to the food that they grow, creating products, maple syrup and black garlic spread, and all kinds of things that, you know, create livelihoods in a market. They welcome newcomers. You know, they understand that we're living in a disrupted time, that there are climate refugees and even political refugees from other parts of the country and part of the world who need a place to live, who need a, and they have a, one of their livelihoods is they actually have sort of a death doula, death and dying coaching and support business. And they operate a memorial grove, essentially a forest cemetery for people who want to die and have their remains stay in this forest. So they've woven together a bunch of livelihoods. There's some people obviously who still work off the farm and for other kinds of jobs, but it's a good example of like, and they get their costs. Their costs are lower because they're living together and they're sharing expenses. And the mutual aid comes in from just helping neighbors, bartering and sharing and working together to build community resilience to face the ecologically disrupted future.
And I loved that death doula business that they do, because you describe it in great detail, and there is a climate-connected reason behind it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Ray Kelleher believes we're not really going to face the future until we face and understand our own mortality, address the sort of death phobia in our culture. So she's really a believer that a healthy approach to death, including, you know, the building altars as a way to honor those who've gone before us, retain a connection to ancestors. We're going to have to, in Ray's view, draw on the power of our ancestors to help us face the future. Ancestors, many of whom have faced even, you know, great struggles in their own past. So yeah, part of her view is let's be honest and talk about death. Let's sort of face it. Let's demedicalize it. Let's celebrate lives while people are still here. So they kind of institute a practice of, one person calls them living shivas, or there are memorial services while the person is still alive to celebrate their lives, not waiting till after they die. So those are aspects of a culture shift that Ray thinks is important in how we face the future.
And even to the details, you know, when my mother passed away in 2012, I just kind of automatically had her cremated. That's what she had told me she wanted. And it was to my horror that I later discovered that the process of cremation is carbon intensive. So you really do go into the details of, you know, this farm providing people with wicker coffins. You talk about burying the bodies 3.5 feet deep, not 6 feet deep, which is now allowed by Vermont. And it is a level at which bacteria can break down the body. It's a process of renewal and rebirth that is contained within death. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I think they realize that there's this opportunity to change the culture and change the burial practices, as you described, Francesca. You know, that we are part of nature. And one of the businesses of the farm is they weave willow coffins, willow baskets and willow coffins, which biodegrade quickly. Or people are simply buried in a shroud. As one character says, you know, wrap me up in my wine-stained tablecloth, the one that I've had at my birthday table for the last 10 years. That's my shroud, and I'm going to go down gently into the ground in that. So, you know, you don't have these, you know, large lacquer rainforest wood coffins and expensive burial processes and cremationist, which, as you say, you know, is another unnecessary source of carbon emissions, when in fact we can, our bodies can break down and join the great cycle. And I think that's sort of the new view and the new culture. And I see it kind of emerging around me, but it was fun to sort of imagine it playing out into the future, some of these trends and new practices. I think it we're heading toward a healthier way of facing the end of each of our lives, not just handing it over to doctors to prolong at any expense.
So, Chuck Collins, let's go back to the past again. As we said before, Altar to an Erupting Sun, your novel, follows many of the key struggles that social justice activists in the U.S. have waged throughout the decades since the 1970s. You talked a bit about the anti-nuclear movement, Sam Lovejoy, who tore down a tower at a proposed nuclear plant. Also, you talk about the demonstrations that occurred at the Seabrook nuclear plant. I remember going there when my son was 2 years old, and it was really a really joyous occasion, but it had a very serious purpose. Talk about the impact of the anti-nuclear movement on the development of nuclear power in the U.S., because it was profound.
Yeah, you know, that the nuclear power industry kind of had a free run, really, 50s to 1960s and even into the 70s. The assumption was that nuclear power was going to be the answer. We were going to build hundreds of nuclear power plants. It was going to, the electricity was going to be too cheap to meter. You know, it was going to be like free. And yet, throughout U.S. history of nuclear power plants, there's been a number of accidents. There was an accident outside Detroit that almost was a core meltdown, but there was no movement there. And I think one of the lessons that Ray Kelleher realizes is you need to do organizing and preparation and education, even when it doesn't feel like you're winning, you know? And so that's what they did. They set out and they, you know, educated their communities, and they showed up at the board meetings, and they learned about the dangers of nuclear power and the economics of nuclear power and nuclear waste. And they just kept pushing and pushing. Then, you know, there's an accident at Three Mile Island, but they're organized. They've already done the groundwork, and that movement then rises up and takes advantage essentially of this moment when people are paying attention to the dangers of nuclear power. And essentially, no new power plants are licensed, you know, after 1980. For decades, a couple small nuclear reactors have been licensed in recent years. But that movement really stopped the construction of nuclear power plants and the decommissioning of many others. So it was a great example of the importance of people power. If that movement hadn't been there, after Three Mile Island, you can imagine the status quo just would have continued on. And Ray, that's a life lesson for Ray, which is, you know, you do the organizing and education even when you can't necessarily see the impact, because what you're doing is preparing for a trigger moment. You're preparing for something that may draw people's attention and awareness to it, and then you want to be organized and ready to go.
And do you feel that lesson also obtains in one of the other struggles that you write about in the book, that is the fight against U.S. imperialism in Latin America? You have Ray go to Nicaragua and El Salvador. Talk about those efforts and her work with the School of the Americas Watch and your own experience with the Institute of Policy Studies that lost two members to violence around the School of the Americas.
Yeah, you know, during the 1980s, you had the Reagan administration funneling military aid to the dictatorship in El Salvador. They were trying to fund a mercenary army to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. And lots of people from the U.S. went to Central America. They actually went to Nicaragua. They, as an expression of friendship, they picked cotton and coffee. And the fictional Ray Kelleher was part of that. And part of what happened there is a whole generation of people had this experience of working in Central America, getting outside of the U.S. bubble, seeing the relationship of the U.S. and U.S. foreign policy to the rest of the world. And also that by their physical presence there, probably deterred a U.S. invasion. The United States, the Reagan administration was developing plans to directly invade and reverse the Sandinista government there. And the fact that there were thousands of people working and living in Central America, volunteering, was a source of deterrent. And all those people came back and became active in their local communities. And Ray Kelleher was an example of that. And she then asked this question, well, who's training the Salvadoran military? Who's training the dictators in Chile? And learns that the United States and Georgia has the School of Americas, which is essentially a training facility for military leaders from Latin America, most of whom working for dictators. And so she is part of this movement to shut down the School of the Americas and draw attention to it. And you mentioned, you know, I work at the Institute for Policy Studies. One of our colleagues, two of our colleagues were assassinated by a Chilean hit squad that was trained by the U.S. at the School of the Americas. So there was a direct connection there. So, you know, it was an example that most people living in the United States wouldn't understand, that our government is backing the wrong people in a lot of these struggles. They're backing the dictators and they're backing the status quo, and they're opposing people who are working for their freedom and independence.
Yeah. And, you know, I also think what's noteworthy is the impact. You know, so often, so many of us who've been involved in these struggles for so many decades just kind of look at the catastrophe unfolding around us and wonder, you know, what did we do? So I wonder if you could weigh in on that, because I feel that the book allows us to celebrate, in a way, our victories, but also to grapple with our failures. What's your own perspective on that?
Yeah, you know, I think part of what Ray Kelleher's life experiences is, yeah, you win some and you lose some, but you hang in there and don't be discouraged, and that we do have some agency, and that these social movements have made a difference. They stopped a war. They stopped an invasion in Nicaragua. They've stalled and slowed the development of nuclear power. And now, you know, and Ray later joins an effort to try to stop a pipeline that's being built in her neighborhood that's going to bring fracked gas to Boston. And that's a battle that they lose. At the same time, they discourage other fossil fuel infrastructure from being built. So you can sort of see that she's plugging away. She's looking for places to make a difference. But as she starts to dig into the climate crisis, she realizes, whoa, the rules are rigged here. You know, trying to oppose a pipeline when you have federal laws that basically give private energy companies the power to just take streets by eminent domain, overriding local and state government. These are all things that Ray just starts to wake up to. It's like, wow, the fossil fuel industry really has captured our political system. So that's one of the, she's bringing her organizer campaigner insights into this moment, but also realizing, boy, this is going to be a tough one to stop the fossil fuel industry because they are so powerful. And that's one of the things that really shapes her at the end of her life.
Right. And so here we go to, she has announced to her group at Hidden Valley Farm, I'm going to go to your book here, Altar to an Erupting Sun, where she reveals her plan to blow herself up and to take out an oil company executive. And her husband, Reggie, pushes back, and he gives all the reasons why that's not a good idea. So let's start there, and then I'm going to read how Ray responds to him. So what does Reggie say?
Well, he and she doesn't really tell many people. She tells Reggie in a kind of intimate way, just saying she's thinking about this. And he just says, this is a terrible idea. It may be cathartic for you, but it's going to have tremendous negative repercussions. Violence just begets violence in our culture. It will lead to the repression of the movements that you care about. It may even lead to, arrests among people at the farm. So don't do it. Think about other, insist on not just having a peaceful exit. Think about other things. Think about self-immolation, which is another tradition that is kind of discussed in the book, but doesn't take the lives of other people. So they really have it out, and they do convene a little group of four, including Ray and Reggie, where they really kind of explore the debates about violence and nonviolence. And that's part of what I wanted to do in the book, was sort of lay it all out in a way that younger people today and anyone today can sort of think about the negative repercussions of such an action.
And so Reggie has said it's going to occasion this huge blowback. And Ray answers him, and I'm going to quote from your book here, Chuck Collins. "I've thought about that," said Ray. "We're at a different stage in the global movement around climate change. For 20 years, we've been watching emissions rise. We've had how many COP summits with how many thousands of pledges, and it doesn't change anything. It doesn't change the trajectory. It doesn't stop the efforts from planning the destruction of Mother Earth and growing their profits. As we sit here, there are men sitting in boardrooms making decisions to invest trillions in new oil and gas infrastructure that will blow humanity past any sustainable temperature limits." And then she goes on to say, "I think it opens up another flank in the movement to keep fossil fuels in the ground. Target companies that are still extracting and their decision makers." She says, "A lot of social change in history has happened because of violence or the threat of violence." So weigh in on her point of view on this. You know, there is a book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. I think many of us look at the mass murder. I mean, I have a button that says climate change equals mass murder. You know, I wonder every day, how have we come to the pass that a few individuals are threatening all life on Earth here and the evolution of hundreds of millions of years for their short-term profits with no real consequences? So weigh in on her point of view.
Well, I think that quote that you read is such an important point in terms of Ray's state of mind. She feels that powerlessness. She is feeling rage. And one thing I notice is people sort of say, well, we should face the future and face the grief of loss. And at different points, Ray is like, well, I'll face the grief, but I'm going to face my anger and rage first. You know, like, don't forget about that stage of our process here. But, you know, she sees how the political system is captured and how our political system, think of the U.S. Congress right now, completely incapable of responding to the challenge that we face. So, you know, I think she's feeling that there's not a lot of other options. That combined with the fact that she's kind of now at the end of her life facing her own mortality and wanting to do something dramatic to make a difference. And, You can empathize with that, you know, given the moment we're in. At the end of her book, her kind of adopted daughter, Alex, says what Ray did was wrong. But what Ray would say is, what bold action are you called to do to defend Mother Earth? And I believe, now speaking as not the author or the fictional Ray character, but I believe there are these pressure points still where we can make a difference. But it's going to not be easy. It's going to require much more disruptive tactics. I heard this morning that two people have shut down, engaged in civil disobedience to physically shut down Line 5, which is the Enbridge oil pipeline in Michigan. It's the anniversary of the oil leak into the Kalamazoo River. And so activists, probably risking serious jail time, have gone out and literally shut the valves down, engaging in that. So, you know, I think we will see, understandably, more militant tactics, more expressions at not just the fossil fuel industry, but their financial enablers. So, you know, there's a group Third Act, which is folks over 60 who are thinking about climate change and wanting to take bold action. They're focusing on, you know, the JP Morgans and the Chases, the big financial companies that invest in this new fossil fuel infrastructure. We're going to have to put our bodies on the line to stop new fossil fuel infrastructure from being constructed. Where I live in New England, there's a plan to expand a private jet airport 400% so that the ultra rich can fly their private jets more and more. That's a bad idea. That's a huge emission carbon bomb that would put billions of tons of carbon into the atmosphere. So people are going to put their bodies on the line to stop the expansion of new infrastructure like that. That is going to be, that's really what we need to be doing in the coming years. And each of us sort of have to ask, what are each of us willing to do for the sake of the future, as well as our immediate lives?
Mm-hmm. Well, Chuck Collins, it's just been great to talk with you about this novel that explores all these issues and more. I mean, it's just a wonderful guide and primer to a decades-long movement that is becoming ever more important, Altar to an Erupting Sun. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca.
Chuck Collins. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to resources about the novel Altar to an Erupting Sun, including a discussion guide and a further reading list. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.